Okay, we are reconvening the meeting now. The break has ended, and I'm going to turn the floor over to Jennifer Rand, Deputy Chief Auditor. Jennifer?
Thank you, Tom. Good morning, everyone. I'm going to proceed, although I recognize about half the group is making their way back to your seat. But if you can please do that, I greatly appreciate it. We want to get your feedback here on this topic, which is very important to us. We're now switching into the discussion of supervision, and that is the accounting firm's responsibility to supervise as well as the individual auditor's responsibility to supervise. The purpose of this discussion is to help us consider whether the current auditing, quality control, and related professional practice standards of the board should include any further direction regarding supervision. I am very pleased to be joined in this session by Professor John Coffey. Professor Coffey has had a distinguished career and is currently a professor at the Columbia Law School. He has expertise in many different areas, including corporations, securities regulation, class actions, criminal law, and white-collar crime. Professor Coffey testified before the Senate in the hearings leading up to the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, and we are very pleased he is able to join us here today to provide some background relating to supervisory structures. And just to make sure, there has been materials presented around that should be at each of your seats, which will help facilitate his discussion. It's not required reading, he informs me, but rather some of the information he may be pointing to when it's for your background information. So if you don't have that, you could raise your hand and we will get that to you, but I think you should have it. Before I turn the discussion over to Professor Coffey, I'd just like to outline some of the key points in the briefing paper to set the stage on what we're trying to accomplish this morning regarding supervision. First, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act included a couple provisions relating to supervision. One provides that the board should include in our standards requirements for the supervision of audit work. The second provides that the board may impose sanctions on registered public accounting firms or the firm's supervisory personnel for failure to reasonably supervise. In response to those provisions in Sarbanes-Oxley, the board adopted certain pre-existing standards or standards that have been in existence by the profession. We adopted those as part of our interim auditing and quality control standards, which contains provisions regarding supervision of audit work. The board also issued a rule to commence a disciplinary proceeding if it appears that a firm or its supervisory personnel have failed to reasonably supervise. Supervision, as it's described in the board's interim auditing and quality control standards, provides direction for the audit partner in charge of an engagement. But what's important to note is there's no specific direction in the board's interim standards or rules regarding the supervisory responsibilities of firm management personnel, such as what responsibilities should firm management have over audit partners in connection with the audit. Should they have any, what should that be? When the board adopted its rule on commencing a disciplinary action for failure to supervise, some commenters to us suggested that the board should provide guidance on the term supervisory personnel. Some commenters also made reference to broker-dealer structures and indicated that they thought there wasn't an appropriate comparison in that regard. The board did not provide specific guidance in the scope of supervisory liability under the Act. However, the board stated that would it continue to consider whether additional guidance or rulemaking would be appropriate in this area. And so that's one of the reasons why we're having this discussion today, to obtain some feedback on this very topic. I will now turn the topic over to discussion over to Professor Coffey, who will provide further background. After his remarks, we will open up the discussion for SAG member comments and questions.
Thank you very much, Jennifer. Not everyone in this room is a lawyer or wants to be. Therefore, I think it might be useful to start out with sort of a brief tour of the forest before we get down to the individual trees. However, because many people in this room are lawyers, I suspect we will eventually get down to the trees, the branches, and the leaves. But let's start with the general background. The federal securities laws have long, long imposed a duty of reasonable supervision on both the broker-dealer firm and all persons associated with the broker-dealer firm, which is a defined term, and I'll come to it later. So it's a two-tier system, both the firm and those people who are associated persons have an obligation to supervise. When Sarbanes-Oxley was written, it is clear that the draftsman plagiarized shamelessly from some of these provisions in the Securities Exchange Act. You only have to read Section 15b-4 for 30 seconds to realize that most of that language has now been copied over in Section 105c-6 of Sarbanes-Oxley, dealing with this duty to supervise. Not only do they define the duty to supervise in quite similar terms, as supervising so that you, with a view to preventing violations of law or the rules of the body, but they also provide almost identically an affirmative defense. So let me read you the affirmative defense for an associated person under Sarbanes-Oxley. Now, this is your statute, not the Federal Securities Exchange Act. That statute, Sarbanes-Oxley says, no associated person of a registered public accounting firm shall be deemed to have failed reasonably to supervise any other person for purposes of subparagraph A if. And there's a two-part test. Part A is that you have reasonable systems and procedures in place to give reasonable assurances that the supervised person will be prevented from engaging in violations of law. So I'll call it a reasonable compliance system giving reasonable assurances. And B, I'm going to read this word for word, such person, the supervising person or the associated person, has reasonably discharged the duties and obligations incumbent upon that person by reason of such procedures and system and had no reasonable cause to believe that such procedures and system were not being complied with. That means that any associated person in a public accounting firm is denied this affirmative defense under Sarbanes-Oxley if, even though there was an adequate compliance system in place, they had reason to believe, reasonable cause to believe, that there was some deficiency in the system where someone was behaving improperly. I'll call that the red flag kind of exception. Now, notice that language focuses not just on who's a supervisory person, but on anyone who is an associated person. Under the federal securities laws, we do define who is an associated person for purposes of association with a broker-dealer firm. And that's in Section 3A.18 of the Securities Exchange Act. Let me read you that definition, because it's quite broad. It says, you're a person associated with a broker-dealer if you are a partner, officer, director, branch manager, skipping some words, or any employee of such broker or dealer, except that any person associated with a broker or dealer whose functions are solely clerical or ministerial shall not be included in the meaning of such term. In short, for purposes of broker-dealer regulation and supervision, if you're above the clerical level, you are an associated person and you have this duty to supervise. That duty can be escaped if you can show, one, that there were reasonable compliance systems in place, and two, that there were no red flags telling you that those systems were not being complied with. That's the world of broker-dealers. You're free to tell me that's not a relevant analogy. I just want to show you that this is where Sarbanes-Oxley came from, and this is what they meant over there when that language was borrowed. Now, how does this play out in practice? Let me here take you to the NASD manual, which is, of course, now called FINRA, but is still basically the same manual. That manual has been in place now for decades, and basically it tells us that every firm is required to, quote, establish and maintain a system to supervise the activities of each registered representative, registered principal, and other associated person that is reasonably designed to achieve compliance with applicable securities laws and regulations and with applicable NASD rules. And the applicable NASD rules go way beyond the federal securities laws because there are very broad NASD rules that require compliance with the highest standards of commercial honor and, quote, just and equitable principles of trade. I'm not suggesting you want to copy that language at all, but just there's a very broad penumbra around the federal securities laws that you have to have some concern about compliance with. Okay. Now, What specifically does the NASD do, demand to have such a reasonable supervision system? This is why I handed out some materials, or had materials handed out, because the key rule is Rule 3010, which is just captioned Supervisory Systems. And it has a number of elements, and I think this sort of tees up for organizational purposes what the key elements of a supervisory system might be. You can certainly suggest changes have to be made, or this is not even relevant at all, but let me just take you through the minimum elements of a supervisory system as it's been in place for a long time for broker-dealers. First, under subparagraph 1, which is right on page 1, there is a requirement for the establishment and maintenance of written procedures outlining what this compliance system will be. That's not in Sarbanes-Oxley. There's nothing on the face of Sarbanes-Oxley that requires written procedures. Instead, Sarbanes-Oxley talks only about having procedures and a system, not necessarily in writing. And I could imagine, unless you establish a rule requiring written procedures, that in some future enforcement proceeding, some defendant in such a proceeding will say, there were no written procedures, but it was the custom, the time-honored custom of this firm, the culture of this firm said, this is what you're supposed to do, and I relied on that. I think you want to avoid that kind of debate, and I think at a minimum you would want some written procedures under which the public accounting firm has to describe what its compliance system and procedures are. That's one. Two, the NASD rule 3010 requires the designation of an appropriately registered principal or principals with authority to carry out the supervisory responsibilities of the member for each type of business in which it engages. That means if you're a broker-dealer firm that engages in brokerage, proprietary trading, and investment banking, you're going to have a supervisory principal with adequate licenses for each of those different functional businesses that you're engaged in. Okay? Next, three, there has to be a designation in these written procedures of a supervisory jurisdiction at each location in which certain activities take place, such as the taking of customer orders. What does that mean? That's sort of a geographic rule. If you've got an office, a branch office, in which you're doing some activity, like engage with customers or taking customers' orders, there's going to have to be a supervisory person for that office. So we have both a functional line of supervision and a geographic line of supervision. And the typical brokerage firm, the branch office, will have either the branch manager or some other compliance officer being the supervisory person. Now, next, this may be more controversial. Rule 3010 requires the assignment of each registered representative to an appropriately registered representative and or other principals who shall be responsible for supervising that person's activities. In short, that means that everyone who's a professional within that firm has to be assigned to a supervisor. There has to be a formal assignment. You are supervised by at least this person, possibly multiple people. So there is not an informal system. You know who your supervisor is, and there may be one supervisor for certain functional tasks and others as the branch manager. Okay. Next, there have to be reasonable efforts to determine that all supervisory personnel are qualified by virtue of experience or training to carry out their responsibilities. This is some kind of quality review on the ability level and experience of supervisory personnel. And finally, there has to be the participation of each registered rep, that's each professional within this firm, and at least an annual interview or meeting to assess compliant issues relevant to that person. Now, on these last two points, I would point out that there recently has been a PCAOB release which imposed a sanction on a Big Four accounting firm within the last 6 months, where the basic allegation was that the firm had knowledge that the audit partner on a particular account was not competent to perform the functions of being an audit partner. If you have that kind of knowledge and you have this kind of system, the supervisor who's retained that person in office as the audit partner has responsibility for any failure that occurs because he has knowledge that this person is deficient and is not able to satisfy those standards. Okay. Now, how has this played out when I'll call sort of the case law? There are hundreds, thousands probably, of failure to supervise cases that are heard by the NASD each year, and I've put some representative ones attached to this. They just give you a sense of how this works. They're simple, short, 3 or 4 page decisions. What the case law has basically said is that the final responsibility for proper supervision rests with the firm's president or chief executive, who can escape that responsibility only by showing, one, that there's been an appropriate delegation to compliance personnel who are adequately trained and licensed, and two, that the senior person, that the president or other senior executive, quote, neither knows or has reason to know that such person's performance is deficient. So you work from the top down and say the CEO can push this duty off to someone else, but only if he's appointed fully, a designated supervisor with adequate experience, and he has no reason to know, no red flag suggesting that that person is not performing adequately. How much supervision is necessary? That's sort of the ultimate question, and here I can't give you a very specific answer. The NASD precedents, and again there are hundreds, are both broad, general, and very fact-specific. Supervisors have a duty, among other things, to, quote, investigate red flags that suggest that misconduct may be occurring and to act upon the results of any such investigation. That's said in several Securities Exchange Act releases, all within the last 3 or 4 years. There's also a common statement that's appeared in a half a dozen SEC releases within the last 4 or 5 years, quote, that the, quote, decisive action is necessary whenever supervisors are made aware of suspicious circumstances, particularly those that have an obvious potential for violations. And again, this statement again occurs like elite motive through several recent SEC releases, and I'll quote it again. When an indication of irregularity is brought to their attention, supervisors must act decisively. Now, what constitutes an irregularity? What constitutes a red flag? You can't define that in meaningful language. But if you have something that amounts to a red flag or irregularity, a supervisor has an obligation to take some action, at least by referring it to the supervisory personnel who has the highest authority in the field. So in summarizing all this, let me point out that the kind of supervision we see within the broker-dealer firms is not strictly linear. You report up, but you may also have other supervisors, sort of a matrix system under which you may have one superior who is in charge of investment banking or trading, and someone else who's a branch manager. They both have responsibility, and the incentives that are created by this system are for the senior executives to minimize their own liability by making sure they put in place senior compliance officers who they believe are competent, and they have no contrary information giving rise to a red flag. That's a very short tour of a subject that can have several volumes written about it. I've just followed what is sometimes called the bikini theory of law teaching. Under the bikini theory, you've covered the critical points, but only just barely, and I suspect that several of you will show me that I may have left one or two points uncovered, but let me stop here.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'd like to turn now to our discussion topics to open up the floor to SAG members to provide comments on these topics and also to ask any comments on the trees that Professor Coffey made reference to. The first discussion topic is how should the board approach the regulation of supervision in a firm's audit practice, including whether to include individuals who are not members of the audit engagement team, such as the national office, regional office, or quality assurance personnel within the scope of potential responsibility for supervisory failures. So open it up to those with comments. And Cindy Richson, let you start.
Thank you. Thanks for the great introduction to this topic, which I know is complex. You did a great job of the bikini theory of law. I've had the fortune of being on the SAG since its inception, and we have always heard about how important tone at the top in the auditing firms is for quality control. And so I've heard others, not in this setting, but in the audit profession and elsewhere, talk about maybe we should narrow the scope of responsibility or liability to supervise, and stems to legal responsibility, to just the engagement partner. And I think that would really be a mistake if we took that narrow approach or narrow view. I think that tone at the top is extremely important, and I was glad to hear John's comments on the broker-dealer regulation as a possible analogy for auditing firms. And I think you've got to keep the incentive with the top person in the firm, the president, CEO, whatever. And I do think it needs to include the national office. Otherwise, we run into an Enron situation where if it was David Duncan or whoever was the quality control person, when they had an objection, they get removed from the engagement. I mean, you don't want to incent that kind of behavior.
Thank you. Greg Jonas.
Thank you. It's ironic that in my first SAG meeting that you have on your agenda, three of my very favorite topics. So this one is at the very top. And it's at the top because I think we can make significant progress here. Let me give you the punchline and then back a little bit. My punchline is that I'm absolutely convinced that supervision guidance cannot end with the engagement partner or the quality review partner or the National Office Technical Experts, that is, the people who are directly associated with the conduct of a particular audit. Our supervision standards cannot end with just those people. Now, nothing I'm about to say should suggest that I think the engagement partner shouldn't have absolute responsibility for the quality of the audit, but I'm looking to extend somewhat the brief of supervision. And in particular, I'm eager to expand it to two types of partners who are not typically thought of in these contexts. And one is the geographic managing partners, and the second is the industry team leaders. Auditing is obviously a team sport, a very complex endeavor. And the signing partner has great responsibility, but the signing partner doesn't control all the things that are needed for a quality audit. Doesn't control oftentimes who gets put on the jobs, whether they have the right training, whether they have the right tools in their disposal to do quality work, whether they're there at exactly the right times, or whether they have the right incentives and motivations to do the right work. Oftentimes, these critical areas are under the significant influence of geographic and industry managing partners, and who control key elements necessary also for quality auditing. So I think it's very likely that in certain circumstances we can have very conflicting incentives being given to the poor engagement partner, where certain geographic or industry leaders are pounding the table for growth and profits, and what the engagement partners hear from a National Office Technical Functions is pounding the table for quality audit work, and the audit engagement partner is caught in the middle. I think there is a need for balanced incentives. I am not opposed to growth and profits. It's important, but it needs to be balanced with quality auditing. And geographic and industry partners cannot be only about growth and profits. They have to have a balanced scorecard of incentives. So, you know, how does this manifest itself in bad audit behavior? Well, I've seen from time to time or heard of instances where a geographic leaders come into a region in a firm, for example, to, quote, turn it around and perform somewhat of an economic miracle. The economic miracle is often involves increasing leverage, the ratio of staff to partners. Perhaps they change recruiting and hiring policies, maybe to get out of the MBA market. Perhaps they stop sending folks to expensive centralized training, or perhaps they don't adequately invest in the tools which are often very expensive, needed to do or conducive to do quality auditing. So I think it's very important that these partners who are essential to the firm, I mean, I'm not denigrating this important function of growth and profits, but rather these partners also need to have a direct burden to balance that with quality auditing. They cannot divorce themselves from the environment necessary for the engagement partners to perform. And I think the more we can do to make sure they have the balanced scorecard they need to help support the poor engagement partner that is caught in the middle would be very helpful. Final point is I think there's also an important role, particularly in large firms, to monitor engagement partner and how they're doing. By monitor, I mean, does the engagement partner have a personal problem that is directly affecting the amount of time they can devote to a job or their behavior on that job? And when these problems become known, or is that partner, you know, have too much to do? Are they supervising too many hours? Is that partner assigned to a new job, but that partner doesn't have the background and skills to do the job, and so we need extra resources brought to the engagement? These things can be, and I think are very often by the firms, monitored.
and to actually not wait for a 2x4 to hit us in the head that, gee, we got a problem with a particular partner, but actually go look and see and then take some actions when these things come to our attention. So this is a long-winded advocation for the importance of a monitoring function about the conduct of engagement partners, coupled with incentives, the right incentives, balanced scorecard for the geographic and industry partners.
Bob Kippers.
Thanks. Couple points. I think the existing standards are probably okay. They're probably fine with respect to supervision within the engagement team. The question on the table, though, I think, is largely the supervision of the engagement team and who is supervising the lead engagement partner, who has clear responsibility for the folks that report up to him or her. We got to be a little careful. I think the, what standards have to work for firms of all sizes and all complexities and all organizations. Now, most firms would have a geographic partner, and many would have industry folks. But I think one of the ways to tackle this is to realize that the smallest and simplest firm has to have these standards work as well as the large and most complex. At the engagement partner level, this is an individual who has many supervisors. In the large firm context, at least. Maybe it goes one place for the quality of the work and the accountability for that. It might go another place for the economics of the engagement. It might go to a third place for assignment and deployment of that partner. So there is a system of checks and balances, but the thing I worry about the broker-dealer model, is there one person accountable and responsible for supervising all the aspects of that partner's work? And I think that's often really goes to several different places. The one thing I would suggest about the current U.S. standards that could use some enhancement is that, there is lack of clarity around, since Cindy called the tone at the top, you might use other terms for it, but I would observe that one fix that might make a lot of sense, would not be difficult for the board to consider, is that in the current version of International Standards on Quality Control Number 1, there are 4 or 5 paragraphs that really speak directly to leadership responsibilities for quality within the firm. Paragraphs 19 through 23 lay out requirements for policies and procedures, for responsibilities, and that is something I think the board should at least consider adding to our current standard, because it does speak to this issue of taking this all the way to the top of the house, if you will, in a way that's not so constraining that it has to be done a certain way, but one that I think recognizes that there are lots of responsibilities for supervising lead partners on engagements.
Thank you. Barbara Roper.
I just wanted to comment that I think it is absolutely clear from the context in which this came up in the Sarbanes-Oxley discussion that it was the intention to create a more robust system than existed at the time, and that that system was intended to include accountability all the way up to the top of the firm. I mean, that's a recurring theme throughout the Act, and it was one of the frustrations at the time was sort of the inability to hold people at the top of the chain accountable for problems that occurred on their watch. It doesn't mean you have to, that everything is a perfect, everything in the way FINRA does this is a perfect model for the accounting firms, but I don't think it's a coincidence that this is where the committee looked when they looked for language in the bill that would guide how this would happen.
Thank you. Galen Hansen.
I don't know that my comments are going to be in counter to anything that I've heard, and I agree with Bob. I mean, this responsibility goes in a lot of different directions as it relates to an engagement partner. I thought I would share with the board a real live experience. I sit on the AICPA's Professional Ethics Executive Committee, which is involved in discipline of its members, and last month we had a meeting. This particular issue came up, and it is not atypical at all for engagement partners not to make all of the decisions on their engagements, particularly as it relates to technical matters, independence matters. In this case, it involved an independence matter of a large SEC client that was not well documented in terms of what the conflict was, but the engagement partner did not make that decision to go forward with the engagement, and clearly independence had been blown. Now the question was, what responsibility did that independence or quality control partner that really made the decision? And effectively, we're faced with a dilemma, because in the standards there's very little guidance on that. Very little had been documented. A lot of it was based on hearsay, understanding, conversations. So I think this clearly is an area that should be addressed. Clearly, there are significant responsibilities within firms that others possess beyond the engagement partner level that really need to be somewhat more defined, not somewhat more, need to be clearly defined and succinctly, and how far you go vertically and horizontally with this, I'm not quite sure whether you go more than one, perhaps two levels. I have a hard time thinking that every time someone does something wrong that it should go in all directions as far as you can go.
Thank you. Liz Cantnier.
Just as a kind of background, all of the CPA firms have a responsibility under the AICPA quality control standards to have a quality control document as a framework, borrowing from our last discussion, that they work within. And the quality control documentation and the extent and the formality of it is the choice of the firm based upon the size of the firm, the complexity of their engagements, the type of work they do. So there is a requirement that we have the things documented that you talked about, of allocation of personnel, training of personnel, hiring of personnel, ensuring that the personnel are properly qualified, assigned to the correct jobs, promoted to positions not beyond their capability, proper consultation between engagement team members outside the engagement team, proper documentation of that, where to go to resolve disputes, who in the office is an expert on a variety of topics, so that if you have a question, you know who to turn to. But all of those things are a part of the framework of what our QC documents should describe. But what's left to us is how voluminous that documentation is. So I would argue that we all have this framework in place, and having been subjected to PCOB inspection, I can tell you that's the first thing the inspectors ask for, which is, what does your QC document look like, and is it appropriate for the type of practice that you're operating within? And as the quality control officer, I can tell you I feel fully responsible, you know, looking at your question, are the quality assurance personnel within the scope? I can tell you I absolutely know I'm within the scope, because I'm looking at the QC document, ensuring that we have controls in place to try to prevent a lack of disclosure where necessary between engagement team personnel and outside. So every day something comes to me from an engagement team where, because of the QC process, needs to be taken outside the team and somebody else in the firm needs to be involved. So for my big four friends here, that could go to a national office, or that could come to me instead in my particular situation. That happens all day long. And one of the things PCOB always asks us for is, was all that properly documented so that we can show who was involved and how and to what extent and what conclusions we came to. What worries me is, what are the things I don't know? That's what I'm not, I mean, of course I'm worried about things I'm told because they're difficult and complex, but I'm more worried about what I'm not being told. And so that's part of what the QC document is supposed to insist on is that people get involved, and that's why we have internal inspections of ourselves, either via the concurring partner, now quality control partner review, or just internal inspection where somebody not involved in the engagement looks at it and ensures that the right personnel were involved and the right communications to the right people were involved. So I'm not exactly sure what I'm saying here, other than I look at all this and go, I kind of think we're doing all these things, and I kind of think we all think we're responsible. But I sure as heck don't want to be responsible for that which I was not involved in, not told about, all perhaps I should have been. You know, blame me for what I did know. Blame me for what I didn't follow up on in accordance with my own firm policy. But I get a little bit nervous when if somebody doesn't follow the QC policy and I'm unaware of it, that I'm also somehow still involved in that. Not the following of it, but that there's something I don't know.
Thank you. Ben Coleman.
Perhaps expanding on that a bit. I mean, we do have, as you know today, the U.S. standards. And we as a firm, and I don't know, and perhaps this is something, you know, to your question number one about advice about where to pursue it, but we do follow ISQC 1, and we require that to be followed for all our firms in our network around the world, and we test against the fact that they are following those standards. Those standards, I think, hit Bob referenced where it hits, I think, some of what the objectives of this conversation are. They were adopted, actually, maybe you can help, but back in 05, because we did it, our second or third year now. And so they are post the Sarbanes-Oxley. And what they do is they also provide a mechanism of the how-to versus what are we trying to do later on and see what's going on. They're actually, what do you expect in the operations of the firm? Similar to what Liz just said is we, when the inspection staff has come into our firm the last few years, they absolutely go and look at the processes of our firm and the quality controls that are required by, based on the U.S. standards, and certainly can look at the application of what we're doing here and leverage that and learn from it and see if there's any expansion. I just one word of caution is when you start analyzing what you're going to do beyond the principles of how the firm operates. These are pretty the principles, but they're specific. You need to have processes and procedures to respond to ISQC 1. It's a good document, particularly around the leadership of the firm and the various levels. When you start going to where Liz just talked about of what is your responsibilities within the engagement team as a leader beyond the activities Greg Jonas was talking about, I think then you're going to get into a significantly different change in cost of an engagement. In other words, does somebody up the line need to start having detailed knowledge of what is happening at that engagement team level and the issues that are involved in those engagements? Because that span of control, whether it's the industry or the geography line, would significantly change, you know, the model where you have a partner and you have a concurring partner around quality at the engagement level. It's just make it clear that it involves those other leadership activities that you're talking about.
David Becker.
I think there's really a useful role for the board to play here because you have statutory language that, as Barbara points out, was put in there for a purpose. But as Jack pointed out, this is language that's cribbed from another a part of the securities laws and refers to fundamentally different business and different types of situations. In the broker-dealer context, essentially the supervisory principles is a way of attaching vicarious liability to somebody more senior for something dreadful that something junior does. A stockbroker defrauds a customer. The question is, well, who in the organization should stop that? Here, it's a little different because while junior people can behave poorly in a variety of ways, the notion is that only the firm
acts when it signs an audit opinion. Plainly, though, that the idea about putting this in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act is to make some people individually accountable, that is to say, you can sue them, for acts taken by the firm. And the supervisory rubric in the broker-dealer context really doesn't work completely here, nor does simply having quality control standards, I'm afraid, meet what the statute is intended to do. So I think that what the board has to do is be quite thoughtful and be quite precise about what it is what is expected of various places within an accounting firm as a matter of supervisory responsibility, which may or may not be the same as having firm-wide quality control standards. And it's not going to be easy, and I think it will require some time, some effort, and some hard thought, but duty to supervise. There's a lot of reasoning backwards. The only way to avoid that is for the board to make out in advance pretty clearly what's expected of people.
Barney Hanisch.
I too agree this is a very interesting topic that, you know, the board probably needs to debate at some length. I think that just a few observations or perspectives. I mean, accountability clearly is important. I don't have a perspective on how high that accountability should go within an organization. I believe that it probably needs to go higher than the engagement team, but I'm not going to sit here and profess to know how high that should go. One of the comments that was made earlier about the NASD Rule 3010 about the establishment and maintenance of written procedures, and I think the professor indicated there's nothing in SOX about a requirement for written procedures. At least that was a note that I made. I think clearly there should be, as a fundamental foundation of any kind of a QA/QC environment, needs to be some establishment and maintenance of written procedures. So I would certainly encourage that. I would also encourage the board and the staff to look at other industries, because there are examples, for example, within our industry of good manufacturing practices, and we have extensive QA/QC operations as far as accountability practices, training, qualification of production workers, and supervision to ensure that the people that are out there producing pharmaceuticals are of the highest quality. So I think there are examples that the board and others can point to, whether it's FDA regulations or just even going into some other companies and looking at some analogous situations as to how those QAQ systems are put into place, how they're monitored and implemented, and where is the accountability to maybe draw some appropriate analogies as you're formulating your thoughts around this topic. But accountability is critical. It's a framework, I think, for some of the quality that goes in, and from an investor confidence perspective, this is a very important topic.
Thank you. Damon Silvers.
I think that the key issue here is the one that appears to be, at least based on the comments so far, is the remarks toward the end of Professor Coffey's paper about the somewhat and necessarily so ill-defined duty to look out for something suspicious. And the question I think that I don't feel like I have a clear answer to, but I'm sure the people here who do know the answer, is whether or not
the current sort of complex of procedures and duties that Elizabeth was describing earlier really embody that idea or not. And if they don't, whether that idea ought to be embodied. It feels as though there's not a lot of disagreement that when someone up the hierarchy in the firm is actually engaged in the audit in some fashion, when they're consulted with on a close question or on a question that's beyond the technical capacity of the audit team, that clearly there's responsibility then. And it also seems pretty clear that that firms feel a responsibility to have quality control procedures and promulgate those procedures and enforce them. But the question is there an affirmative duty to watch for suspicious things on the part of higher level management and audit firms? Seems like a plausible sort of duty to have, but I don't feel like at the moment I know whether the answer is that duty exists today. I would welcome Professor Coffey's further comments on the importance of that duty in the broker-dealer scheme.
Be very brief, but both under the broker-dealer scheme and under the affirmative defense under SOX, if you become aware of irregularities, then I don't think you can have confidence that the system is already adequate to prevent violations of law. So I think at that point, the question is, what do you have to do? It can't be call the SEC and blow the whistle. That's not the first step. It's going to have to be what is the responsibility of someone above the engagement team who becomes aware of a red flag or irregularity, hears gossip from the associates, as it were. What does he have to do? Go to the nationwide compliance officer, go to the audit committee of the board. You come up with different procedures, and I'm not here to tell you what the best procedures are, but you don't have the safe harbor under SOX as well as under the federal securities law, and I think you want to design into your system some statement of what the responsibility of all senior personnel is if they become aware of irregularities. All we know from the federal securities laws is you must take decisive action. That's not self-defining.
John Kellis.
Thank you very much. I won't repeat what has been said about ISQC1, but I think we discussed quality control generally at this group before, and I probably reported then that at the time of approval of ISQC1, the IAASB was certainly very keen to ensure that appropriate responsibilities were allocated to others in the firm as well as the engagement team, and that the taking of responsibility for audit quality throughout the firm, which encompasses this sort of thing, was an important element. So I would certainly support what has been said about the fact that ISQC1 deals with some or all of these matters. Secondly, I think that of the standards that we have issued, this is one that has generated probably most feedback in terms of implementation. And of course, the smaller down the firm scale one gets, the more difficult it is to implement some of these matters, and ISQC1 is one where I think professional bodies throughout the world have felt most need to provide support to smaller firms in order to implement them properly. Thirdly, I think when one is considering the audits of registrants and you have additional requirements, at an engagement level, it is probably, it's always no doubt creates difficulties, but it is probably easier at an engagement level to be implementing additional requirements, should that be the case. And therefore, I suppose that when it comes to matters of quality control, I would hope that the PCAOB would particularly consider the case for considering whether ISQC1 does not in fact meet the appropriate standards that you're looking for here, because as soon as you seek to impose firm-wide procedural matters, clearly the implications for any firm trying to implement these are rather more considerable than engagement-specific matters, and particularly if you think of firms which may have only audit one or two registrants, then to impose firm-wide requirements may cause particular difficulties. So I think there's a very strong case for saying, does the international standard fit the bill? And I would certainly hope that it would do, and to think very carefully about whether there is a need to impose requirements beyond that.
Glenn Turner.
When a firm signs an audit report these days, they sign in the firm's name, and the firms tell us that the reason they do that is it's the whole firm that is really delivering that product to investors. And in that process, with probably the majority of the audits, that's usually the engagement partner and concurring partner and maybe one or two up above that are associated with that, but probably in the vast majority of the cases, not broader. But there are instances where very key quality control points touch on that audit that are very key. The risk assessment, all the firms tell us about how strong and important their risk assessment and client retention processes and procedures and the judgment of those people who make those decisions are to those, and certainly we've seen that even in some recent cases. It is also vitally important that as people go through consultation, and all the firms have a process for raising issues through consultation, including where there's disagreements, that there's a process that goes through, and in cases people like Bob or Randy or Sam or Vinny will ultimately make the decision as to what numbers and what disclosures go in those financial statements to investors. And at that point in time, their judgment is as important as anyone else's judgment on that audit. And because that's such a key quality control process, I don't see how you can limit the quality control in those particular situations where it runs up there to anything short of those type of people. And we've also now instituted even whistleblower programs within the firms that can become very important and critical here as well. And I think that's those type of things all have to be encompassed. It's just like with Arnie said, with the manufacturing plant, it isn't just the people down on the process line that are held accountable. If a plant goes bad, it's actually not just the plant manager. It's going to be people up the ladder that get held accountable. And I see no real difference between that and what goes on in these firms. And I actually think that's what was contemplated when this was put into SOX. In fact, this piece, some of this language was not there with the original bill introduced by Dodd and Corzine. If you go look, it actually came in the first draft that came out of the Sarbanes staff, where it gets added at that point in time, and the discussions were of an NSRO type notion, but it also came out of testimony that was provided by members of the old POB at the time in a hearing, and that was that it was all this encompassing, because we just had problems where people felt that quality control and didn't go up to the very top, and some people at the top were able to were not part of being able to make that thing happen. And so there was a notion of it is this broader thing. It's not just the engagement team. So I'd encourage you to go back and take a look at that testimony around that point in time and some of those drafts of the legislation as well.